This is TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio.
This is the one they're talking about.
TalkZone.com.
Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Hi, this is Mike Wilkening, along with Jim Clements and Eric Edholm, welcoming you to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News, where every week we bring you the news, scoops, and rumors before they happen from the NFL, NBA, and college hoops as well.
We'll take a glance at the NBA playoff picture, plus an early look at the college basketball top 25, and some Cincinnati Bengals talk.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News!
Welcome into this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. I'm Mike Wilkening, and I'm joined by Lakers assistant coach Jim Clements, as well as Eric Edholm. Hub Arkish usually hosts this program, is taking the week off. Betty Arkish, Hub's mother and the wife of Pro Football Weekly founder Arthur S. Arkish, passed away last Saturday after a long illness. We want to extend our condolences to the Arkish family. Guys, let's begin the show by taking a closer look at the Western Conference. The conference final matchup has been set. Number one seed Los Angeles against number three seed Phoenix. Both teams sweeping their conference foes in the semifinal round. And this series will begin next Monday in L.A. And Jim, let's begin by briefly looking back at the Lakers sweep of the Jazz. Now that you've had a few days to look back at the film and reflect, what impressed you most about your team's play?
Well, I thought that as this particular series moved forward, Mike, I thought our ability to play better defense certainly helped us, and once again, this is the third straight year that we faced the Jazz. So we do know them very well, and obviously, you know, they know us. But I thought that we started to take things away from them in their half court sets, and surely them missing Emeka Okorafor helped us, because he normally, you know, is one of those athletes and shooters that stretches our defense. So we didn't have to stretch our defense, and that allowed our switches closer to Boozer and Millsap. We were able to get to them a lot better. But game three, Korver stepped in and had an outstanding game. But generally speaking, though, our overall defense as the series progressed got better. And I think as we move forward in the Western Conference Finals, this will bode well for us, because we always talk about, you know, championships are won at the defensive end. So I think our guys are starting to see that our defense can carry us.
You know, Jim, when you look at your team, obviously, you know, Pau Gasol is an important piece of that puzzle. He's been a great player in this league for a long time, but it seemed to me in watching from a distance that he really kind of has elevated his game. Just sort of talk about what he's been able to do, and obviously looking forward a little bit to the Suns. It's going to be an interesting matchup with your front court against their smaller guys. But talk about what Pau's been able to do in elevating his game.
Well, it's very interesting, Eric, that about 2.5 years ago, when we first acquired Powell, he came to us on a road game. We were on the road, and his first game with us was in Washington, D.C. And everyone talks about how difficult it is to relate to the triangle offense and the triple post offense where we run. Powell stepped in, and he ran it from day one like he'd been in it for over a year. Hmm. And his skill set and his ability to make adjustments and is just suits what we run wonderfully. He is probably one of our most skillful players. He's one of our best. Certainly, I think, you know, Kobe gets all the attention, obviously, because of who he is and what he can do, you know, the spectacular. But in my mind's eye, I wish Powell would touch the ball at least one time, you know, coming, you know, every offensive set, because of the decisions that he makes. You know, we talk about, and every coach in the world will say, you want to get the ball inside. Well, what better person can you throw the ball into is one that's also willing to share it. And like I say, his left and right hand, turnaround, jump shot, jump hooks. I mean, he's just gorgeous to work with. And we're bringing him more to what we call, our listeners understand the technical part. We're bringing him more and more to our pinch. And when you have a skillful player that can play with his back to the basket and then make offensive decisions, and who's virtually now our playmaker in a half-court set, either at the pinch post or the low post, then you've got a player that can do wonderful things for you.
Jim, the Suns have won 22 of 26 games, 31-8 since the All-Star break. What stands out about what's different about this team in the second half of the season?
Well, I think, once again, you know, I mentioned a few minutes earlier that defense wins championships. And now they started down this road over a year ago when Terry Porter was the coach. He came in talking about he wanted to, you know, make them a better defensive team, but somewhere along the line, the players didn't buy into the offense that he wanted to run. So Alvin Gentry stepped in. He brought back their offense's ability to push the ball up and down the floor, but he also maintained the vigilance of trying to get them to play better defense. And since the All-Star break, they have bought into the philosophy that they have to play better defense. The proof is in the pudding. They have played better defense. Their offense has been still being played at a very high level. So they're working on all cylinders. And when you have a player with the value of two-time, you know, most valuable player, Steve Nash, pushing the basketball, and he's held the ball on every possession and making, you know, outstanding decisions and getting other people involved. And when you back off of him, you know, he still has the wonderful outside shot. You have a very good offense now with a consistent defensive effort at most of the time. So they have become a lightning rod out here in the West.
Jim, as we wrap up this first segment here in the final 30 seconds or so, just talk a little bit about their bench, too. I mean, you look at the work of Channing Frye in Game 2, Dragic in Game 3, Jared Dudley in Game 4. They've got Lewis Edmondson, Barbosa, a number of guys. Just talk about what those guys have been able to contribute to.
Well, I think they bring the energy. We talk about Dudley and Robinson. You're two guys that Dudley stretches you at the offensive end with his three. Robinson hurts you with, you know, his ability to keep balls alive, set picks. It's just the energy. And, you know, the players, the stars get the highlights. But when you have those worker bees, so to speak, you know, Dragic has done a very good job of spilling Nash and giving him energy at the end of the basketball game, and he's growing as a young point guard in this league. Frye does a good job in stretching your defense. So once again, you've got to recognize what players bring to the table, you got to understand personnel, and you better be ready to play.
We're back with a look at the Eastern Conference playoffs next on Pro Football Weekly Basketball News. Jim Clements, Eric Edelman, Mike Wilkening here on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. And guys, we've looked at the West, and let's turn our attention to the East, where, as we tape, the Cavaliers and Celtics are engaged in what could be one of the most pivotal series in recent memory. Now, Boston took the upper hand in this series after an absolutely stunning 32-point win on the Cavaliers' home court Tuesday night. And while the series is still being played as we tape, we know this about the series. It has major, major ramifications. Cavaliers have played wonderfully throughout this season, but everybody's eyes are on July 1st when LeBron James gets free agency. And you add to the fact that the Cavaliers have never won a title, and there's another layer of intrigue here. And Jim, I'll start with you. You've been on so many title-winning teams. Does a team have to be humbled like the Cavs were in Game 5 to eventually learn what it takes to be a champion? What's the lesson they can take from that?
Well, a team doesn't necessarily have to be humbled. The whipping that Boston put on them in Game 5 just brought them back to reality that every time you step out on the floor during a playoff series, you know, you're subject to, you know, getting embarrassed if you don't bring a good effort. And I think that Boston just generally just shut them down. And I think they played at a level, once again, that Cleveland didn't expect from them, because, you know, I think that you kind of take it for granted that being at home, everything's going to go your way. Well, that certainly was an ill-conceived notion on their part. And if it goes to a Game 7, I can't see Cleveland being assured that just because the ball game's going to be played on their home floor, that's going to be an automatic victory. So they are literally backed into a corner with Game 6 and Game 7 possibly looming within the next weekend.
Eric, no matter the outcome of this series, what's really impressed me about Boston is the way that Rajon Rondo has sort of become an elite point guard, and the way he's meshed with the so-called Big Three, which was kind of the engine of that title-winning team of a couple years ago. When you look at this team, what are your impressions about how they've been able to kind of mesh old and young here?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody obviously, you know, points to the big three, and they're clearly, you know, the sort of the bedrock of this team. But Rondo, like you said, he's the energizer, but he's also, I think, an underrated player in terms of his intelligence. You know, we've just seen him sort of break down the Cleveland defense over and over. They're wanting him to take that outside shot. He's kind of resisting the temptation. But when it's there and he thinks he can make it, he takes it and often does make it. So, you know, it was so impressive. I thought, you know, that incredible performance in game four, one of the best Boston playoff performances of all time, the triple-double, that was great. But then coming back the next game after being held scoreless in the first half of that game, you know, it was impressive to me in the second half. He didn't force things. He took what came to him and really was a pivotal player in that third quarter when they pulled away. So, you know, I think it's time they start looking at this team and say, look, you know, maybe they are a little old at spots, but this should be the big four now. I mean, because Rondo is such a crucial part of that team, and he's going to be the difference whether they can move on and ultimately get back to the finals.
Guys, as the Cavs and Celtics fought it out, Magic, well, they rested. They simply crushed the Hawks in the semifinals, sweeping that series with ease. Now, I attended game four in Atlanta, and two points really jumped out to me about Orlando. One, their depth of scoring options, and the second was kind of the machine-like way they took apart Atlanta. There was no letdown. There was no loss of focus. This was a prepared team hitting on all cylinders, and they're certainly experienced, too, obviously, defending Eastern Conference champions. Jim, when you look at the Magic from afar, what stands out about them, about the way they've swept through the postseason to this point?
Well, I certainly believe that the Magic are the team on a mission throughout this playoff series. You talked earlier in the segment about being humbled. Well, if I'm an Atlanta Hawk fan or a member of that team, that was humbling, Mike. I mean, and in fact, not only humbling, it was embarrassing. So I think that's going to be interesting to see if that team can rebound from the way Orlando, you know, they just manhandled them, to be honest with you. I was embarrassed for them. And like I said, but Orlando's on a mission. I think that they're playing this season and this playoff season certainly as a team. They got revenge in their hearts and larceny on their minds. So I don't know who's going to be there waiting for them, Cleveland or Boston, but certainly whichever one, they've got their work cut out for them. I think Orlando's serving notice. They want to be the Eastern Conference representative.
We're back with a closer look at a couple of NBA teams who had their playoff dreams halted this week, next on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. I'm Mike Wilkening, and alongside me is Eric Edholm and Lakers assistant coach Jim Clements. As the Lakers, Suns, and Magic have moved one step closer to the NBA title, several other teams are picking up the pieces after their postseason dreams were dashed. For Atlanta, San Antonio, and Utah, this is a time to assess flaws and start looking ahead to next season. And Jim, I wanted to get your take on the Utah Jazz, a club that played the Lakers very tough, but was swept all the same out of the semifinal round. What stands out about the Jazz after playing them for four games?
Well, I think that their biggest question is now, what are they going to do with free agency? The rumor was last year that Boozer may not be coming back. Well, he did come back. And as we left the arena the other night, the rumor was again that Boozer may not come back. So I think with Boozer being kind of out there, I'm quite sure he is going to entertain other opportunities. And the fact that Okur, the injury that he had being an Achilles, it takes usually anywhere from, you know, from certainly 9 months to maybe a year to longer for those injuries. I think they've got some decisions just to make, which, you know, how they're going to go. Obviously, Deron Williams is one of the better guards, top three in the league. But you can't win in this league, not over the long haul, with just an outstanding guard. So I think their personnel decisions that they make going forward in the draft and possibly free agency and trades is going to be a telling point as to how they view their future.
I guess this is going to end up being the post-mortem segment of the show, but I'll follow up in the same way that you guys dispatched Utah. The Suns dispatched the Serbs pretty handily. I know the games were close in the scoreboard, but you know, they won convincingly at the end. You know, and this Spurs team, you know, it's interesting to sort of parallel them with the Celtics. I think down the stretch, everybody looked at the Celtics, the way they were playing, said they're not going to go far in this, in these playoffs. The same could have been said about the Spurs. They got to this point. They seem to have a cap on what they can do. Jim, if you were the architect of this team, I mean, do they need that sort of Rondo-like influence? What would you add to the mix to make them more viable going forward? Do they have an open window to keep winning?
Well, I think they do. I mean, it's very interesting, you know, at the end of last year, guys, they were supposedly making trades and strengthening their team to compete with us, you know, meaning the Lakers. You know, they brought Jefferson in. They made a couple moves to bring in a couple of better defensive players. Well, Blair, a second-round pick, ended up probably being the most recognizable addition that they made. You know, Richard Jefferson, I love his game, but Richard, when he was in New Jersey playing along with Jay Kidd, got maybe anywhere from 6 to maybe on good nights 12 to 14 points in easy buckets in transition. And San Antonio doesn't push the ball back in that type of vein, so he didn't get those extra points that I think they were looking for. And so I don't think they made a bad move. I think they just have to figure out and incorporate different ways to get him involved offensively. But Duncan's getting older. You know, can he give them the rebounding, and can they push the ball? Ginobili, I thought, had a wonderful end of the season. His last 2 months, to me, he was probably the most valuable player in the league, just the way he played and carried the team. But once again, we're talking about, you know, perimeter players. And in this league, you've got to have bigs if you want success, not only in the regular season, but also throughout the playoffs.
Certainly the Spurs, kind of a team in transition, still a contender. Atlanta Hawks, also a team in transition, eliminated in 4 games by Orlando. And, you know, again, in watching this team, obviously a lot of decisions have to be made. Joe Johnson, who might be their best player, is a free agent. Mike Woodson's status as head coach was up in the air as we taped. And, Eric, I turn to you on this one. Atlanta, in my estimation, seems like they're a team that might be a little bit caught in between at this point. I don't know if they're necessarily of the same caliber of an Orlando, of the top teams in the Eastern Conference, but there's certainly a good core of talent there. How do you fix the Hawks?
Yeah, that's a good question. A year ago, they looked like a scary team. They looked like somebody who was sort of, you know, on the horizon, becoming, you know, the next Orlando, so to speak. But, you know, it's clear, obviously, like you said, they are in transition. I don't think Johnson will be back. You know, if LeBron leaves Cleveland, he could be the replacement there. So, you know, I hate to say it, but I think they're going to have a year where they, you know, they sort of let these young guys grow and maybe, you know, shed their skin a little bit. Some of these, players that are, they're talented, but don't necessarily fit their needs, and use a year of transition. You know, they're not going to have a high draft pick. They're not going to have probably an impact player coming in from somewhere else. So, you know, I think it's a team that if they move on to a new coach, might spend a year sort of getting used to a new system and working into a new rotation a little bit.
Well, certainly the Hawks have a lot of big decisions to make. It'll be very interesting to see what they do. Next, we'll take an early look at next season in college basketball on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. Jim Clemens, Eric Edelman, Mike Wilkening here on Pro Football Weekly at Basketball News. And guys, every year after the Final Four, there's a rush to pick next season's number one. And then there's a rush of early entries into the NBA draft that occurs. And now that the early entry deadline is passed, it's finally safe to take a comprehensive look at who looks particularly strong entering the 2010-2011 college basketball season. And with this in mind, we bring in Mike Huguenin, the college sports editor of Rivals.com, to talk college hoops. And Mike, Rivals.com released its early top 25 for next season this week, and Duke is atop the list. And we know about Kyle Singler and Nolan Smith returning, but who else will make the Blue Devils elite once again?
Well, I think the Plumlee brothers are big physical guys. They're never going to be big-time scorers, but they can be Brian Zubek types in Duke's offense. And the way they play defense, that's fine. Big guys who take up space, throw their elbows around, and rebound, that kind of stuff. A very good freshman point guard, Kyrie Irving from New Jersey, coming in. Transfer from Liberty, Seth Curry, Stephen's younger brother, who was the leading freshman scorer in the country 2 years ago. before he decided to transfer. So this is a formidable team, even with Shire gone. I mean, the Plumlee brothers will be good. Irving is a huge quickness upgrade over Shire. Seth Curry can shoot. And you're right, Singler and Nolan Smith are back, a nice senior duo to build around. Duke, you know, if you were a Duke hater the last couple of years, you really haven't had much to hate because Duke has been down a little bit. But they're back where they expect to be. So that means Duke is going to be back on the top of the hate list for a while now, I think.
Mike, as a Missouri grad, I am ineffably thrilled to see my Tigers listed ahead of the Kentucky Wildcats. And obviously, a year ago, they were the big story in college basketball. Huge exodus now with all the underclassmen coming out. Talk about this Kentucky team. What's it made of? Who are going to be the important parts? Obviously, the coach is a significant pillar there. But what can we expect out of the Wildcats, whom you have ranked 12th to start the season?
Yeah, this is a team that lost five underclassmen, and all five could go in the first round. I think there's no question that four of them are locks. You wonder about Daniel Orton, extremely talented big man who really played like 11 minutes a game, and he would have been better served by coming back. Obviously, the lure of the money got him to go pro early. But Calipari knows what he's doing in terms of recruiting one and dones. He's bringing in probably one of the two or three best recruiting classes in the country. A kid named Brandon Knight from Fort Lauderdale is a big-time scorer. There's a Enos Kanter, who's a big kid, who's going to be a Patrick Patterson type for Kentucky. I think the one thing you worry about if you're a UK fan, yes, there's going to be talent, but it's not experienced talent. And eventually, you know, like it did this year, I think that kind of stuff catches up with you. I think Calipari, you know, he's always going to recruit the guys who think they are one-and-done guys. But I think he realizes in his heart of hearts that is not a way to win a national title. You have to have one-and-dones, which that's fine. You also got to have some established upperclassmen who are role players. And that's the one thing that Kentucky is not going to have again. And until they get those kind of guys, I think Kentucky's a team that's going to tease, have a ton of talent. The NBA scouts are going to be, you know, camped out in Lexington watching Kentucky play, but it's always going to catch up to them in the NCAA tournament until they get some upperclassmen who are content to be role players.
You know, Mike, let's talk a little bit about the conferences. Last year, the Big East was heralded as having the best conference, but then when it boiled down to tournament play, the Big East teams vanished like vapor. Who do you think this year, conference-wise, will have the best conferences?
I think if I'm a Big Ten fan, I'm already looking forward to basketball season. Football, you know, Ohio State's going to be good in football, Iowa and Wisconsin. But in basketball, I think Purdue and Michigan State are going to go into the season thinking they are legit Final Four teams. I think Ohio State and Illinois are thinking if everything breaks right, we can get to the Final Four. Minnesota is an experienced team. Northwestern could be very intriguing. Wisconsin's always going to be good as long as Bo Ryan's there. But, I mean, Purdue and Michigan State, when Etuan Moore and Juwan Johnson came back, decided to stay in school, if Robbie Hummel gets healthy, Purdue is a very likely Final Four candidate. Michigan State's been in the Final Four 2 years in a row. The only key player they lose is Raymar Morgan. As talented as Morgan wasn't exactly the most consistent guy. So if Kalen Lucas comes back healthy, Michigan State's a legit Final Four team. Ohio State's bringing in a tremendous recruiting class. Illinois lost no one of note off their team, plus is bringing in three top 100 guys for its recruiting class. So that's four really, really strong teams. And I think the Big Ten's going to go into the season as the number one conference.
You know, Mike, a team that kind of intrigues me is Florida on the list, number 20. Return all five starters. I thought they played well in the loss to BYU in the first round. It's sort of interesting, I think, what Billy Donovan is building there again after those two straight title teams. What's your assessment of them and what they're building, and also kind of the Southeast Conference? We talked about conferences. They were a little bit down last year. Where do they fit in that picture?
Yeah, actually, I think the SEC is going to be even worse off this coming year. Ole Miss lost Tarico White to the draft. Mississippi State lost D. Boss to the draft. Arkansas lost Courtney Fortune to the draft. None of those guys are likely first-round picks, and indeed, I don't think Fortune and Boss get picked at all. You got to wonder what they're thinking. Perhaps they didn't like to go to class, but I think the SEC is going to be down, and I think Florida is going to be a beneficiary of that. Florida does have all five starters back. Alex Tyus, the power forward, toyed with going to the NBA. He smartly decided to come back. They're bringing in a pretty solid recruiting class. They got a five-star big guy coming in, Patrick Young. Problem with Florida right now, they have three scholarship guards, just three, because Ray Shipman transferred out. And one of those three played in seven games last year. They're hoping, it's got to the point for Florida's backcourt, they're hoping a kid graduates early from high school in Gainesville, a kid named Scotty Wilbekin, who comes in and is a freshman this fall. So, a very, potentially very, very powerful front court. A backcourt, though, that their starters are going to have to play. Kenny Boynton and Irving Walker are going to probably have to play 35 minutes a game every single outing, and that's, I think, going to wear on Florida eventually. But you're right, I think Donovan, you know, 2 years in a row they didn't make the NCAA field at all, went to the NIT. I think they're back on an uptick. He's got a pretty good recruiting class already for 2011, including a guard named Bradley Beal from St. Louis, a top 10 kid. So I think Florida is getting back to where it was in recent years. Florida's still always going to be a football school, but Donovan obviously has done a good job there, and I think Florida has a legit chance to win the SEC next year, even with that questionable backcourt.
Mike Hugan is the college sports editor at Rivals.com, and we thank him for joining us. We also say goodbye to Jim Clemens and wish him well as the Lakers prepare for Phoenix. We transition NFL talk next on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. We turn our attention now to the gridiron and the AFC North champion Cincinnati Bengals in particular. Dave Lappin is a longtime radio analyst on Bengals broadcast, and he joins us now to talk about a very intriguing team. And Dave, let's begin with the obvious, the signing of Adam Pac-Man Jones. How risky a move is this for the Bengals, and what role or roles do you see him filling in Cincinnati?
Well, it's an interesting move. You know, it seems that, like Chris Crocker, said the safety for the Cincinnati Bengals. He said, we've turned into the Betty Ford Clinic in the National Football League to rehab players. And it's true to an extent. I mean, they've had some success, taking guys off the street that have had some issues and have faced suspensions as a result of the issues. Cedric Benson, reclamation project panned out exceedingly well for them. Hank Johnson last year played well for them also after being suspended for eight games the prior year. With his arsenal of guns that he was involved with, and now Pac-Man Jones, and you know, Tank was a teammate of Pac-Man's at Dallas. I think Tank's going to be a great leader for Pac-Man and how to weave his way through the web, so to speak. You know, keep your mouth shut and your ears open and listen to Zimmer. And Mike Zimmer, guys, basically had a come to Jesus meeting with Pac-Man Jones and said, "Look, you're not going to start. We've got two first round cornerbacks that we really like, young guys. You know, you'll be in the running for the nickel spot. He's a return guy. Obviously, he's in the mix for kickoff and punt returns. And, you know, he said, you're going to have to play more discipline than you ever played for any team prior to this. We've got basically a zero tolerance policy. You're not going to disrupt our chemistry. And so they look at it as, you know, if he's hit rock bottom and he's straightened himself out, they've got themselves another bargain at NFL minimum for a couple of years. The downside risk, other than the national beating they knew they were going to take, was minimal. The upside risk could be pretty good.
Yeah, Dave, on the other side of the ball, you got a couple other carnies joining the festival here. Antonio Bryan, obviously, you know, has had sort of a scattered past, and you look at a guy like Matt Jones, obviously, you know, he's had his share of troubles. But I want to talk about more on the field stuff with the receiver position and also tight end. We mentioned Bryan, we mentioned Jones. You also had Jordan Shipley to the mix, interesting little slot receiver from Texas, and then Jermaine Gresham, the first round pick. You know, is just adding a collection of talent to these positions going to really boost the passing game? I know Carson's had pretty good offseason. Talk about what you think the passing game is going to look like. Is it still going to defer to the run?
Well, you know, I think they did run the ball so successfully that's going to be a staple. But Carson last year played with a thumb injury on his left thumb that needed to be surgically repaired at the conclusion of the season. And he had to, like, backhand hand off the football to Cedric Benson. It was amazing they didn't have more ball security issues. He could not use his left hand whatsoever. And now with it surgically repaired, the play action stuff will be a lot better. The running game will be smoother even than it was with respect to exchange between a quarterback and running back and handoffs and that sort of thing. And I think they are going to that is going to be their bread and butter, the running game. The offensive line is structured to be a run-oriented group. Pass protection is not their strength. Run blocking is. But if they put themselves in situations, third down and makeable situations where they can play action pass and throw the football, I think that's where they'll thrive. And like you said, the guy that probably in the league had as good an offseason as draft to improve what he's got is Carson Palmer. I mean, the goal is to put more tools in the tool belt, and they certainly did that. You know, the guys that you mentioned, they're looking forward to make contributions. Gresham's a size-speed ratio nightmare. Matt Jones is. You know, these guys are 6'6 and can run. You know, I think they think Antonio Bryant's still at the peak years of his career. And don't sleep on Desmond Briscoe, a kid they got out of Kansas in the sixth round who could make some noise. But I think they feel like Jordan Shipley is going to be their slot receiver and be the TJ Houshmandzadeh-like guy that is where he's supposed to be, when he's supposed to be there at all times for Carson Palmer. I think Gresham and Shipley will really make a big impact in their rookie season.
Dave, in the final minute we have or so, what's the difference between the 2010 Bengals versus the 2006 Bengals, who were also defending champions and won impressively in 2005? What's the difference between those two teams?
I think it's maturation. The 2005 team was still pretty immature and didn't know what they didn't know and really didn't handle success all that well. And I think this group has been through that and a bunch of other things. And there are players like Carson Palmer being the linchpin who was experienced all those learning experiences. I think they know the pitfalls to avoid. And I think this group is ready to deal with the success. And that's the biggest difference. The 2005 team wasn't. I think this one really is.
Dave Lapham is one of the radio voices of the Cincinnati Bengals. We thank him for his time this week. We'll be back to talk more NFL on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. Mike Wilkening and Eric Edholm here on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. And Eric, you and I have been at Pro Football Weekly since 2002, and we've seen and reported on any number of interesting stories, but I don't know if we've ever seen anything like the Brian Cushing saga. And let's go over some of what we know about the story. News breaks last Friday that Cushing, the star strong side linebacker of the Houston Texans, will be suspended 4 games for violating the NFL's policy on anabolic steroids and related substances. And later, we learned that Cushing's positive test, per ESPN.com and the Associated Press, is for HCG, a fertility drug and a banned substance. And we also learned that the positive test occurred in September. Cushing appealed the decision and played the entire season, and played quite well. This would be interesting enough, but the Associated Press, in an unprecedented decision, decided to take a revote on the Defensive Rookie of the Year, which Cushing won in landslide fashion the first time around. They also opened up voting on the All-Pro outside linebacker position once again after Cushing earned second-team honors at that position in the first vote. Now, after all this, Cushing retained Defensive Rookie of the Year honors, but he did lose his spot on the All-Pro team. Now, Eric, from an on-field perspective, I think the thing we need to point out is Cushing and missing the first 4 games, this really hurts the Texans. They faced several top tight ends, Dallas Clark, Zach Miller of the Raiders, Jason Witten of the Cowboys, Chris Cooley of the Redskins. Now, Cushing did a respectable job against Clark last year, and the Texans' defense held up very well against Indianapolis, and that was one of the reasons they played the Colts so tough. As we know, any regression at all by the Texans' defense could be a big-time problem for the club that has playoff aspirations. But I think the bigger picture aspect of the story, Eric, is what people I think are really going to focus on here going forward. And what do you take from this? To me, the timing from which there was the positive test to when the appeal and when the announcement was made seemed like a very long time. What do you make of all of this?
I think it's silly. I really do. I mean, here's a guy who, like you said, who tested positive in September, early in the season. As far as we know, he did not test positive thereafter. Otherwise, we'd be looking at something more serious here. But obviously, the appeal brings it to this season. He's going to start out the year on the bench, it appears. So, yeah, I mean, this whole thing is kind of silly. The revote to me was just ludicrous. I think it's an extremely slippery slope. You know, why don't we go back and revote on Julius Peppers in 2002? Why don't we revote on Kevin Williams All-Pro in 2008, when he initially tested positive? So, to me, that stuff is silly. And you mentioned the Texans. I mean, you know, I think everyone wants to sort of graduate them to the next level. They finish strong. They look like one of those teams. Maybe this is the year. I get a feeling that with their brutally tough schedule, one of the toughest in the NFL next year, now this happening, I get a feeling they're not quite ready for prime time. I have sort of a bad feeling about this team this year.
Well, as we wrap up this segment, Eric, one of the teams they played last year and played well at the end of last year was the New England Patriots. And Tom Brady has some interesting comments about this particular 2010 Patriots team. Kind of shed some light on what he said.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Tom is not a big talker in the offseason, and he's got his two young children on the West Coast. And obviously, as the years have gone on, he's not 24 anymore. He's not fighting for that best parking spot for the best practice player there in New England. He spends more and more time in the offseason with his children. Understandably so, not critical of that at all. But, you know, he was kind of looking back at last season and using words like mentally tough and why the Patriots struggled in fourth quarter. It was very revealing. I think he was sort of backing Bill Belichick here and saying, this is not sort of the Patriots of old. You know, we need to be more mentally tough, you know, more stronger in those fourth quarters because against elite talent, they were not a very good team. So interesting that Brady is stepping his game up now a little bit in the offseason.
There's always a lot to ponder in the NFL, even in the offseason. We're back with one more topic to discuss next on Pro Football Weekly at Basketball News. Eric Edholm and Mike Wilkening back on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. And Eric, our chat earlier with Dave Lapham, one of the Bengals radio voices, got me to thinking, who's the most likely division champion in both conferences to repeat? So I turn to you, Eric, and ask, are the Bengals that most likely team in the AFC? Is it the Patriots, whom we talked about last segment? The Colts, the Chargers? Who's the most likely repeat team to win their division in the AFC?
Yeah, I think we're talking about those last two teams. I mean, look, as much as the Texans may have grown up, as intriguing as the Titans are coming off a strong finish, I still think Indianapolis is the best team in that South Division. So, to me, Indianapolis has got to be one. AFC West, so weak behind the Chargers. They've got to be right there, maybe 1A as far as a division title repeat likelihood. And then, you know, Patriots have a lot of competition with the Jets and Miami. Now look at Cincinnati. Boy, I think Baltimore is the most talented team in that division by far.
Well, you look at the flip side, you look at the NFC, and I see more questions than answers. Certainly the Cowboys, very, very strong in winning the NFC East last year, but that's a tough division. The Vikings, who knows if they can repeat last year's effort. And the Cardinals, the big change at the biggest position on the field with Kurt Warner retiring. So nobody's quite sure who's going to win that division. But I see one team that sort of stands out in that conference as most likely to repeat. I know it's sometimes maybe not going out on a limb saying that the division Super Bowl winner, defending Super Bowl winner, I should say, is going to repeat as a division champion. But nobody's ever repeated in the AFC South. I think the Saints end this curse this year, this NFC South curse I've heard about. I think the Saints repeat. I think they win so impressively. And I think they're very dangerous and have a chance to repeat again, perhaps as Super Bowl champions. That'll do it again for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. We thank Mike Huguenin of Rivals.com and Dave Lapham of the Bengals Radio Network for joining us. Randy Meyer is our producer and engineer. Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News originates out of Syndication Networks in Chicago, Illinois. Hub Arkish will be back in the host chair next week, and we certainly hope you'll join us, same time, same station, for Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.